activation of purpose and consciousness across all of humanity. That my grandmother was a big proponent of that. To honor her, I think it's pretty much my job and duty to have a purpose, focus on it.
Well, thank you so much. Any advice you'd give to your younger self or the younger generation?
I would just say, be yourself. It's hard, but it's so rewarding. And even when you come into conflict, when you're being yourself, that's a growth moment. I know it can be triggering and everything, but if you ride the waves of that conflict, you learn more about yourself. Your strengths, what your boundaries are, what you will and won't put up with. And we need everybody to be their unique self. I like to say, we're as unique as snowflakes. We're so unique. So right. Quit trying to be like everybody else. Yeah. Plus, I grew up in the 80s where nobody was like everybody else.
Right,
so let's get back to that.
Oh, I love it. Well, thank you so much. And I it was such a pleasure to have you on. And I have such fond memories of you and your son. And just how much joy and pleasure he brought to me, and that I'll never forget the two different names that he gave me. And
well, I say that my son really does have a village in our acting, because we're a family. We go through a lot training together, and I want to thank all of you, actually, because he's got so many examples to look up to, and I can't wait till he blossoms, because we can all take a part of that and be like, that's my kid, we did it.
Maybe I'll have Tony on here.
Yeah.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO Community Radio for a KBOO Fights Back campaign. We are raising $75,000 by December 31st to keep community media strong. Stop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, for an in-person meet and greet on Saturday, December 6th, or Sunday, December 7th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Meet hosts, producers, board members, and other KBOO members. Enjoy light refreshments, tour the station, and make your year-end gift in person. Learn more at kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:01 a.m. Next up is the bike show.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
Hello and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBOO.FM. My name is Alon Robb and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler, and our engineer as always is Ty Walker. Thank you, our listeners, for joining us today. We are happy to be carried by fellow community stations across the land, including Radio Tacoma and KORC Radio of Corvallis, Oregon, where our show is aired every other Sunday at noon. The station, streaming at KORCFM.com, is in its own words, free-form local radio dedicated to playing great music and building community. And speaking of community, KBOO is currently fundraising. If you care about community radio and have the financial ability to donate, please consider a donation to KBOO. We have been on there since 1968, And since the start, KBOO has been a true community resource and voice, always important, and especially in these days. In the first half of our guest is geologist and cyclist Ian Medin. Mr. Medin was chief scientist and interim director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and has been the ride-along geologist for Cycle Oregon, a project that brings together thousands of cyclists and works closely with local communities. In the second half of the show, our guest is Nicole Hollis, the Safe Routes to School manager for the Atlanta Department of Transportation, and the first person in her role, working with a new agency set up in the city of Atlanta. Before we get to our guest and to some news items, a warm welcome to my co-host, Nedra Deadweiler. Are you on the air, Nedra?
Yes, I'm here, Alon. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Doing great today. The sun is out and it's warmer outside, so it's a good day.
Well, send some sun our way. And you went recently to an artist residency, I believe?
Yes, I was at Hambidge Art and Science Residency in North Georgia. It's really beautiful up there. An ecosystem very similar to the Pacific Northwest. Take in artists from all over the place. I recommend it. No internet in my studio.
Oh, that was great. Okay, thank you so much. I will say goodbye for now, and you'll join us at the half-hour mark. And before our first guest, Ian Medin, just a few quick news items from the vast bicycle universe. Titled Utah Rolls Forward on a Statewide Freeway for Bikes, the Salt Lake Tribune newspaper reports that the state plans for a 3,100-mile network of protected lanes. Governor Cox unveiled the plan, the first complete map of the planned Utah Trail Network, and it's a freeway-like system for bikes set to link communities in all corners of the state. Backed by the state legislature, it would be the first of its kind nationwide. We need to spend some time outside, more time connecting with people, and more time exercise, and the way to do it is through our bicycle system, said the governor. $90 million have been allocated thus far, and the system will connect big and small communities across the state, reaching even the tiny community of Mexican Hat, population 21. 500 miles of paths out of 3,100 planned have been built, and the network would be built so it could be reached within 1 mile of 95% of Utah residents. And it would also be connected to 33 colleges, 31 national and state parks, and 74 transit stations. Way to go. And in another story, this time from Spain, Bike Rumor magazine reports about reaching Spanish flood victims by bikes and about building light cargo bikes from airplane parts to help carry supplies. In October 2024, the Spanish city of Valencia and its surrounding areas received in just 8 hours the normal yearly total rainfall. The flooding devastated communities, with 230 people losing their lives and thousands left homeless or left without any belongings. Roads were affected and rescue efforts hampered. Endurance athlete Juan Duell, nicknamed Empty, a native of the city, began riding to hard-to-access areas on his gravel bike, navigating the mud and debris and climbing over piled cars. He was soon joined by over 200 cyclists, providing much-needed supplies and aid. Jens Budder, chief engineer for the British cycling company Vielo, who is also a professor at Chemnitz University of Technology in Germany, challenged his students to build something meaningful out of a retired Airbus plane, and they decided to build cargo bikes. The company, aided by several other companies, the company Vielo, went into production with the bikes weighing less than 30 pounds and able to carry a load of over 150 pounds. And the gentleman, Juan Duell, his nickname is Empty, he earned that nickname as a result of a rare hereditary condition which caused several internal body organs to be removed. Yet despite many, many surgeries, he became an ultra runner, an ultra cyclist, and a cycling hero too. So bravo to you. And now our first guest of the show, and who is Oregon geologist and cyclist, Ian Medin. Mr. Medin was chief scientist and interim director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and has been the ride-along geologist for Cycle Oregon, a project that brings together thousands of cyclists and works closely with local communities. Good day, Mr. Medin, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. I'm really happy to be here.
And we're happy to talk about to have you here.
I love to talk about geology and biking.
I probably, when I was mentioning the rainfall, the flooding, you probably had something you were thinking about that, perhaps. Before we get to geology, I like to ask people about their early cycling experiences. Were you always connected to a bicycle, or is this something new?
No, I'm a baby boomer. I grew up in the suburbs in California. I rode a bike as a kid. When I started going to high school, I got a 10-speed, which was a really big deal. Actually, it was a Peugeot U08. And I rode to school during high school. And when I went on to college, I commuted on that same bicycle all the way up to the point where I graduated from Oregon State University in 1986. So I had that for many, many years. And subsequently, whenever I was able to, I used my bike for commuting to work. So I was stationed in Baker City, for instance, for several years, which was a very easy commute, except for the ice and snow in the winter. And then for about the last 10 or 12 years that I worked with Dogami up until, which is Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, up until I retired in 2022, I was commuting from Lake Oswego, which was great exercise, but sometimes in the middle of the winter when it was cold and wet and dark, it was a little hard to convince myself to get out there and do it. But I've always enjoyed riding, and my interest in other riding other than sort of commuting and recreationally kind of started back in 2013 when I just decided I needed to get in better shape, and I was kind of getting, I was mid-50s, I was getting older, and I had heard about Cycle Oregon a lot, and so I just decided out of the blue I was going to sign up for it, and that turned out to be just the beginning of a great adventure and a great association with that organization.
So you're definitely a dedicated cyclist. A few months ago, one of our guests was from the city of Toronto, head of their program to clear paths, including in the snow and rain, and they have 80 people working there, so I wish we had it here. So we'll get to Cycle Oregon, but I'm curious, what led you to study geology? Of all the fields of study, why geology?
So I think it comes down to my youth. My parents took my family backpacking in the Sierra Nevada every year, I'm told, from the time when I was two. And so that's my memories of summer, is these vacations and these beautiful landscapes in the Sierra where there is so much rock to see. And I don't think I was really that much focused on the rock, but the landscape really grabbed me, and the way that you could see the bones of the earth poking out and the fabulous scenery that was involved with that. And so when I went to college, I was originally studying to be a pre-med student. And after a couple of years of that, I found that I didn't have what it took to do pre-med. And so I was, at the time, I had a work study job working in a lab that did genetics research. And so I thought, okay, I will get a genetics degree because I I'm sort of partway there, and that's related to what I'm working on. And so this was back in the old days, right, when you actually had a physical catalog of mm-hmm. classes. So I'm flipping through the catalog mm-hmm. to get to the GEN section to look at the genetics classes, and the catalog falls open to GEO and geology. And I read the titles of the classes, and I thought, that's what I want to do. They're going outside. They're looking at rocks. That sounds like fun. And from, changed my major immediately and never looked back.
And the department that you worked for, tell us a little bit about what's its task. What does it do?
Sure. So the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries has two functions. One is to regulate surface mining and drilling in the state. And then a separate organization is a scientific research organization, which studies originally mineral resources. Back in when the agency was started in the 1930s, it was all about service to the mining industry. And in fact, the agency had a program where any Oregon resident could bring in an ore sample and have it assayed for whatever gold, silver content it had. And starting in the 1970s, the mining industry was largely defunct, and so the agency started looking more at environmental geology, and then in the 80s and 90s moved into geologic hazards. And so it's the primary function is to provide useful geologic information to the public so that they can make good decisions about how to manage resources and to adapt to hazards. And so that's really kind of been the focus throughout. But what society needs out of that information has changed over time.
And during your career, you filled various roles. I'm curious about what does a state geologist do? Is it like a poet laureate? Do you get to go to parties all day, or what do you do?
No, actually, you get to go to meetings with legislators and other government officials. It's not all it's cracked up to be. So the state geologist is, it's two things. You are the official geologic expert for the state, and you are also the director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And so most of your time is taken up with trying to manage this agency of 30 to 50 people and manage the politics, working with the legislature and governor's office and other interest groups, federal government, to try to keep the department going, and also to try to make sure that people are able to make good decisions about issues where geology impinges on their lives.
You are listening to the KBOO Radio Bike Show. All shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. And we are lucky and fortunate and happy to be carried by fellow community radio stations in the U.S. My name is Alon Robb, and our first guest today is Ian Medine, geologist and cyclist. So you mentioned Cycle Oregon. Tell us a little bit about that ride.
Well, so the first time I did it in 2013, I knew virtually nothing about it other than I knew that it was kind of an iconic Oregon thing. The ride at that time started in John Day, and it went down to Burns and Diamond out in the eastern Oregon desert, which is an area that I had worked at in geologically quite a bit. And so I was quite familiar with it. And as I was riding, I noticed a couple of things. First off, all of the other riders spent most of their time looking at the butt of the rider in front of them. And every time that I got off my bike to stop and look at the interesting rocks in the road cut, people would pull up and go, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And it's like, "Yeah, I'm okay. Actually, I'm great. This is really interesting. You should look at it too." And so on the second day, I went out and I put a little note up. They have a rider services tent, and there's a board where you can post things, And so I said, anybody interested in the geology of the area, meet me behind the trailer here at 5 o'clock, and I'll give you a little spiel. And so the first day, like three people came. And the next day, 10 people came. And the next day, like 50 people came. And so I really enjoyed that because I like talking to people about geology, particularly in an environment like that where it's so easy to see. There's no trees. It's dramatically shown in the landscape. And apparently somebody from Cycle Oregon noticed that, because next year when I signed up for it, they contacted me and said, oh, would you be willing to get up and talk on stage about what we were doing? And that started now a more than a decade-long association where I go along on the rides and I write up a blog that describes what people are going to see day to day. And during the ride, I do presentations in the evening. And anybody that rides by me with a question gets an answer.
No, oh, sounds wonderful. And the route of Cycle Oregon, if I'm not mistaken, changes every few years. So you really get to see a wide variety of geological formations. You know, on the Cycle Oregon site, some of what you wrote and talked is on, and I really enjoyed reading it. It had a nice, you know, combination of both scientific knowledge, but also very accessible. So can you give us maybe a sense of what you might encounter geologically speaking on a particular day?
Well, so my focus in trying to describe geology to people really depends on them being able to see something in the landscape, whether it's rocks exposed in a road cut or a landform, a mountain, a valley, a cliff or something that you can relate to the rocks that are making it up. And so it kind of depends. If you're in Western Oregon, most of what you're going to see is roads going through forests and really ugly brown and gray rock in road cuts, if you see anything. And it's pretty hard to actually come up with, you know, a good story out of that. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes with those rides, I have to use imagery, LIDAR imagery, which is a very detailed topographic image, mm-hmm. to say, you're riding through a gigantic landslide here that covers 10 square miles. You can't see it, but if you took away the trees, like this image mm-hmm. does, you'd be able to see it. When you're out on the east side where there's not that many trees and there's a lot more rocks exposed, there's just so much to see. Mm-hmm. Almost every ride that Cycle Oregon does encounters some of the Columbia River basalt, which is a series of lava flows that erupted 16 to 17 million years ago, covered almost two-thirds of the state in layer after layer of black lava. Mm. And that shows up very, very frequently. It makes dramatic cliffs. Anybody that's driven through the Columbia River Gorge, virtually everything you see in the gorge is Columbia River basalt with its characteristic cliffs and hexagonal columns that make up the rock in those cliffs. Mm. So that's one of the more common features that we see throughout the state.
And Cycle Oregon, I've never went on that ride, but from what I read and heard from people who have, it really seems like an organization, a project that tries to give back to the communities, work with local people. A lot of the money they raise, they donate to good causes. So I appreciate that. You know, I'm curious, you study geological time. I'm curious if that has any effect on your worldview, how you act, how you treat your neighbors, your loved ones, your animals. You know, in light of the fact that the time frame might be 4.5 billion years, does that mean that things that affect most people, you just shrug them and say this is nothing compared to the history of the Earth? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, that perspective that humanity occupies such a tiny fraction of Earth's history, and you know, 100 million years, a billion years from now, we will have just been this tiny little window. No, regardless of what we do, we will not persist more than a few million years at most. And we'll be lucky if we get that far at the rate we're going. But what it does make me feel is, you know, when I see changes like climate change that are going to dramatically alter virtually all life on Earth, and landscapes will change and sea level will rise and the world will change dramatically in a very short period of time, and mostly for the worst. From a geologic perspective, Doesn't matter. That's happened time and time again. Mm-hmm. And we are here despite that having happened time and time again. So the only constant is change in the land, in the sea, in the climate, in the life that lives on Earth. But what it does mean is that we are really the only victims of what we are doing to the planet, because we are the only ones that care about having healthy ecosystems and wildlife and, you know, a functioning climate. And so the changes that we're making to it are just going to impact us, and the Earth is going to continue on its own without really caring about us. Mm. So we're only hurting ourselves.
And thankfully, there's so many, you know, good people and organizations that are aware of it, and may they, we, you know, triumph. We need that. Our time just is flying by, but I have to ask you a question that whenever I mention to friends that I'm going to interview you, wanted to know about the big one, as we call it. You know, this. You've studied earthquakes. We're part of the Cascadia subduction zone. It's a fault off the Pacific coast. So in a few minutes, is there good news about, are we expecting another major earthquake, tsunami? And I won't hold you to your prediction.
That's okay. Yeah, so there will absolutely be another subduction zone earthquake, a magnitude 9 subduction zone earthquake. There have been 19 of them in the last 10,000 years, and that works out to about one every 500 years. It's been 325 years since the last one, so we are in the window where one could occur, but it might not be for several hundred years more. If it were to occur today, we would undergo dramatic impacts. We would be, most Oregonians would be without services that they expect, like water, power, medical services, that sort of thing, for at best weeks, more likely months at a time. All of our coastal communities would probably be completely destroyed and be unoccupiable for years. This is all fairly well understood and was actually laid out in the Oregon Resiliency Plan, which looked at those impacts. So if it happened tomorrow, we're in big trouble. If it happens in 50 years, and we spend those 50 years working to strengthen our buildings and our infrastructure, then it need not be catastrophic. And those kinds of changes are expensive, but not if you spread them out over 50 years. And so by making sure that every new building we build is earthquake resistant, and every new water system that we put in is earthquake resistant, and as the old stuff gets removed from the population, we will end up at some point at a much more resilient state. And the thing that makes me optimistic that we're going to get there is that many organizations, originally the big organizations that manage infrastructure were like, well, you know, I don't believe it. You have to prove to me that there's going to be an earthquake. And we're finally past that point. They understand it. They accept it. And increasingly, they are building the kinds of changes that they need to make their systems resilient into their operating budgets and plans. So the Portland Water Bureau, that's just, they've got a long-term plan to make all of their systems earthquake resilient. Mm-hmm. Can't do it today, but they're spreading it out, and it's written into the plan. The Department of Transportation, same thing. They have done an analysis. They've got a long-term plan, and once it's in the plan, it's just sort of automatic. You don't have to keep convincing people that there's a problem, because it's part of the maintenance program. Mm. And so that makes me encouraged. But again, we have a long way to go, and we just need to hope it doesn't happen for another 50 years.
Yeah, I thank you for that explanation. I'm an optimist by nature, despite the facts sometimes. So I'll ignore the fact that, for instance, the head of FEMA in Texas right now didn't know that there was a hurricane season in the U.S., or that the head of the medical, health services doesn't believe in vaccine. I'll leave that aside and not ruin your day. I don't know where our time went. We didn't operate by geological time here. We have about a minute, so if you could just tell us about your hobby, your occupation, carving stones.
Sure. So towards the end of my career, working for Dagami, I was doing field work out in the Columbia River Gorge, and I kept bringing home pieces of that Columbia River basalt that I described that had really interesting shapes and really interesting natural patinas. They get sort of a gold coating on the outside, but they're black on the inside, and I knew that because I broke them open with my hammer whenever I found them. And so I started to bring those home and polish them so that I could juxtapose that golden exterior with the dark interior and use the natural shape. And that just turned out to be so much fun that it has become a total obsession. I have hundreds of rocks from all over Eastern Oregon, mostly collected out of the ditch along the side of the highway that I now shape and polish to make these objects that are really, the rocks themselves have an incredibly long history. Tens or hundreds of millions of years, perhaps, and that individual piece of rock has its own history that eventually led it to be lying in that ditch. And I'd love to exploit and honor that history, fancying it up a little bit and then moving it along in the next phase of its long journey.
And you have a nice website where I saw samples. Yeah. Just don't mention the word gold. Somebody in the White House might want to steal your stones. Our time has just flown by, and we have been speaking with Ian Medin about his work as a geologist, stone carver. I didn't mention that he's also a river guide, and also his love of cycling. Thank you for being on the show. It's been a pleasure, and all the best with whatever adventure you create next.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a great time talking with you.
We will now take a short musical break. When we return, Nedra will speak with Nicole Hollis, Safe Routes to School Manager with Atlanta Department of Transportation.
Oh, it went by so fast.
It always does.
Beloved was right, you really are very careful with the metaphor. Not giving you a lot of public speaking.
Yeah.
You're the one who
I just have the gift of the
Bike Radio Show, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming on KBOO.FM. In the first half hour, Alon spoke with Ian Medin, geologist and president of or executive director of Cycle Oregon. Totally ready to join a ride. Anyone else? And in the second half hour, we are speaking with Nicole Hollis, who is the Safe Routes to School Program Manager for Atlanta DOT. We are in the season of giving. Support Community Radio. KBO is fundraising to continue the programs of Buy for All Community in Portland and beyond. If you have the opportunity and you can donate, please do and help us stay on the air. And so, Nicole Hollis, She is a Safe Routes to School program manager with City of Atlanta, Atlanta DOT, and encourages students in one of Georgia's largest school districts in active transportation, biking, and walking, serving over 50,000 students. She has over 10 years of Safe Routes to School experience and has effectively planned for the entire state, including with GDOT and Atlanta Regional Commission. Beyond Safe Routes, she is a collaborative partner on infrastructure projects, Vision Zero, 2040, Free Bikes for Kids, ATL, Save Kids Worldwide, and more, and highly awarded. Most recently, received the award of Champion for Children by Save Kids Worldwide. Nicole, welcome to KBOO Bike Radio, and happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. A day early, but thank you.
Okay, I missed it. You know, it's never too early to celebrate a birthday.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so good to have you here.
Thank you.
You are a big person here in like serving in the capacity of cycling, and we will definitely talk about that and, you know, your role and your work, and also just being new in this position, kind of creating this dimension in Atlanta City. But before we get that, can we talk about you and your bike riding or early experiences on a bike?
Yeah. So of course I'm from Atlanta, and my first experience on a bike actually was when I was in elementary school. My dad and my sisters, we all used to ride to a local park nearby, and we used to do that regularly. But I actually learned how to ride a bike at a young age, but then I stopped when I got to, of course, middle school and high school, and I really didn't get back into riding a bike until I started working in transportation with Safe Routes to School. I got back on a bike actually, I want to say back in 2017, when we were doing a bike parade event at a local elementary school here in Atlanta. And it was so much fun. I just had a chance to be able to join in with some of the kids that live pretty close enough to bike. This particular school actually started a bike bus initiative. I know back then they called them bike trains, but now they're called bike buses. And so I had the opportunity to kind of experience that same type of joy that they did during that event. And most recently, I'm trying to get an e-bike at some point. So I'm hoping, you know, to be able to do that, because here in the city of Atlanta, we are looking at, you know, schools as opportunities to add in bike infrastructure. And we've actually done that around a few of our schools. And most recently, one of our middle schools, we just launched a second phase of a walk. We call it a tactical walk bike lane near a middle school in Southwest Atlanta. So that's kind of been my experience. And definitely I wouldn't say I'm like an advanced bike rider or anything, but I understand how, you know, having that type of transportation can help fill a void. And just through my work with Free Bikes for Kids Atlanta and being able to also distribute bikes to children in need, I know how valuable a bike can be to an individual, but especially to a child as well.
Yeah, so I know that you're a mom, because like I said, we've worked together before in the past. I know that you're a mom. Yeah. And thinking about, you know, sometimes parents do have hesitancy of biking to school or getting kids on a bike because it may not feel that the streets near them are safe enough. What is that bridge for you? How do you communicate to parents that this can be a safe form of transportation? How do you make that help parents to make that leap?
Yeah, so number one, although I would love to say I'm a mom T is what I say.
Okay.
So I definitely have, you know, nieces and nephews who are, you know, ride bikes. But as far as how we communicate to, I guess, families and parents and students about bike safety and just getting on a bike, you know, it starts with, you know, offering them the ability to feel comfortable, number one, and having a bike. Some of the communities that we work within, students don't have access to a bike. So the first step, usually most of the time, is working with our community partners to figure out how we can deploy bikes to schools so that kids can get more familiar, more comfortable on bikes. And then doing things like instructional bike safety classes, whether those are inside the school day or outside of the school day. So just working with PE teachers or various groups to set that up. Most recently, we formed a partnership with Varian's Bike Works, and they have this activity in Atlanta that's called Cone Crusher. And we were able to go to schools where we know there are kids that don't have bikes and have the opportunity to bring bikes and helmets and set up a course to get them feeling comfortable on a bike, but also preparing them or getting them road ready to ride a bike on the real road. And some of these schools are the same schools that we are, you know, working with to help distribute bikes as well. But also education is valuable. So we've done things like bike to school day events where, you know, we work with schools on planning activities to encourage biking. And that's another way to get, you know, families comfortable and to also, you know, share with them, you know, the value of being on a bike. We also have done things like play street events, where we close off a portion of the school street and open it up for kids to walk, bike, roll, and just have a good time. And so, you know, I think using innovative approaches to, you know, offer the space for kids to bike, you know, in a safe space, and also just providing them with those materials, but also, you know, providing that education and being able to work with, you know, students and parents and staff on, you know, getting them, as I say, road ready and giving them the space and time to be able to get comfortable with riding a bike. So we do a series of different activities, but those are just some of the ones that we've done most recently.
Okay, sounds good. I'm going to take a little bit of a break right here and just reintroduce you and KBOO. So thank you for joining us today. We are on KBOO Bike Radio out of Portland live and streaming on KBOO.fm. We are speaking with Nicole Hollis of Atlanta DOT Safe Routes to School program. And so you kind of jumped into some of your current projects, Nicole. I'm wondering,
yeah,
you know, how did you get into Safe Routes to School from the beginning? Why Safe Routes? Why transportation?
Sure. So I always tell people I tripped into transportation. It wasn't something that I originally thought that I would be doing. I actually went to school for communications. So my major was public relations and journalism. And I actually, after I graduated from Georgia State University, I went on to do AmeriCorps. So I had a chance to give back. And I did a program called Green Corps, where we went out into schools and taught kids about environmental education. And a lot of the schools that I worked with were within Atlanta Public School District, which is the same district where we do a lot of our Safe Routes to School programming. And so there is where it really started my love of wanting to work in a capacity to see kids do well and, you know, just see them thrive. And so I went on to work in a school for a few years as an educator, and just really had more of an opportunity to understand the ins and outs of working in a school and what that structure looks like. And so I knew that I didn't want to stop there. I felt like I wanted to do something more, but, you know, that was still school and community driven. And so I went on to work in the consulting world, which is how I got into transportation. I worked on a program that encouraged people in Atlanta, Metro Atlanta specifically, to get out of their cars by taking alternative modes of travel, such as walking, biking, and basically remote working, things like that, to help cut down on Atlanta traffic. And so in return, I would go out to different corporate offices and businesses and talk to HR professionals and leaders about the value of their employees being able to take these commute alternatives to work, and in return, they will be rewarded. And so I did that for a while, and then I heard about, at the time while I had just started out in transportation, I heard about a program called Safe Routes to School, and I, you know, definitely saw the connection there of having worked in schools and been a part of different initiatives, and having, you know, encouraged adults to get out of their cars to take alternative modes of travel to get to work, it was the perfect opportunity for me to align both of those things in my work at that time in my career. And so I started a position under the Georgia Department of Transportation's Resource Center, where I was able to work as the Metro Atlanta coordinator. So I service four counties and over 100 schools throughout Metro Atlanta, and had the chance to provide technical assistance and really work one-to-one with parents and students and staff on building Safe Routes to School programs in their respective areas. And so, you know, since then I have not stopped. I've worked in several schools all across Atlanta, and you know, just excited about the journey that I've been on since then.
Yeah, it sounds really incredible. Thanks for sharing, because any young person that's listening right now might find themselves taking a path that they didn't intend, and hearing how you've made it to where you are now and the great things that you're doing could be an encouragement to them. So I believe transportation is a lifeline of our communities, and it's a great connector to everything and for everybody. What role do you see transportation playing out in communities in Atlanta? How do you see transportation, active transportation, playing roles in the city?
When I think about transportation, I think about quality of life. So transportation is not just the means for people to get somewhere, but it's also a way for them to actually thrive. People use transportation not only just to get to work, but to be able to do the things that they love to do, or to connect with people, to open up opportunities for them, just to be able to live, you know, a better life. And I feel like when it comes to our youth, starting them out early with understanding the value of having sidewalks in their community and having proper infrastructure definitely, you know, is an opportunity for them to be able to, number one, just be able to experience their neighborhood, their community, but be able to connect to people and go, you know, places that will help them to, you know, thrive in life. And, you know, just open up various doors for them. You know, transportation, even for students, I've always heard, you know, throughout certain schools that, you know, PE is always limited in some schools. And so just having the ability to go different places and having things like sidewalks or you know, like I said, proper infrastructure gives them the ability to be more physically active, and just be able to, you know, have that experience, you know, that some people may not be able to have. And it also offers accessibility. So, you know, having having transportation offers accessibility for everyone, but, you know, for a child that may need to get somewhere, you know, just being able to have that for them matters as well. So, yeah, I think of transportation as quality of life, something that everyone needs, but especially for kids, where in this generation, you know, a lot of the kids that I see, you know, that are walking or biking to school, it's important, especially if they're walking alone, to have, you know, proper infrastructure to get to where they need to go, or especially to school, especially mm-hmm. in places here in Atlanta where, you know, there have been things like chronic absenteeism or, you know, we've heard of those types of things, but just being able to, for students to have, you know, proper paths to walk or bike to school, that opens up doors for them and just offers, you know, a better quality of life.
Sounds like you're connecting things like, you know, what that could be barriers for success in school as also a transportation issue, that to be able to have a safe way to get to school, you know, deal with that chronic absenteeism or tardiness or whatever. It's not just to get to a place. Yeah, quality of life in different ways, helping students to be more successful in the classroom. You also work towards Vision Zero, working towards zero deaths. 2040 mm-hmm. is not that far away. Yeah. Although the number is huge. 15 more years. So, and just thinking of some of the challenges that you're facing, I mean, it sounds like it's infrastructure. What do you need? What is needed for schools to get the infrastructure that they need to make it more possible?
Well, so there are a few things here in the City of Atlanta Department of Transportation that we're actively doing. So for, as it relates to Vision Zero, we started working with schools as of last year on safety action plans, which are comprehensive documents that lay out infrastructure recommendations and non-infrastructure recommendations, so programming recommendations that we need to work on with these schools that we've identified. We actually looked at the schools all across the city of Atlanta to understand where all of the high injury networks, as we call them, were located and where we were seeing crashes, whether that was, you know, traffic related crashes, but where we were seeing those in proximity to schools, and we were able to come up with this high priority list of schools. We call it our top 25 list of schools that we've identified to deploy safety infrastructure and also to do programming such as, you know, pedestrian and bike safety education. And so we just wrapped up our first six safety action plans back in July of this year. And that process included things like listening sessions where we were able to come into the school and hear directly from students and parents and staff about some of the barriers getting to and from school and what are some of the safety improvements they would like to see in their communities happen. And so we were able to, you know, work alongside with them to understand those barriers, but also we did things like walk audits where we actually walked some of the routes where the kids are walking to feel what they feel when they come to school or what they see, and understand how we need to work together on improving those things to make their route easier, safer, and more accessible. And so the schools that we did six of those action plans with six elementary schools, and this year we're focused on making some of those safety improvements while also continuing to work with those schools on Safe Routes to School programming. We're working hand in hand with the schools so that, you know, kids understand, you know, proper traffic safety education. So doing things like understanding the rules of the road and how to cross streets properly, how to ride on bikes properly, how to be a safe pedestrian, but also doing it in a fun and interactive way, which is why we've been able to work with some of our partners on doing things like Cone Crusher or implementing special projects like pop-up traffic safety gardens, which we call, which is basically like a mock road that teaches kids how to properly cross streets and be safe as if they're on a real road. So those are one of the things that we're doing. So every year we're focused on working with a set number of schools, and this year we've identified four schools from that top 25 list, including two high schools and a K through 8 school and a K through 5 school. And so we will continue that process as we go through all of the schools in the City of Atlanta Public School District as a way of helping us to reach Vision Zero and ensuring that no child is harmed getting to and from school.
Sounds great. I'm wondering, Nicole, we are kind of getting towards the end of our time, and sure. you've worked locally and you've worked regionally and statewide. What are some changes that you've seen over the 10 years that you've worked in Safe Routes? What are some changes that you've seen that you'd like to share?
I've definitely seen more interest and parent involvement. Of course, the bike bus movement has definitely taken off all across the United States, and people like Sam Balto, who's been instrumental in helping to advance that work. But even here in the City of Atlanta, we have quite a few schools that have started bike bus initiatives here. I've also seen a lot more kids wanting to get involved with Safe Routes to School, whether it be coming up with strategies to improve their communities. I've worked with several high school groups as far as clubs that have been instrumental in bringing safety improvements to their schools, and even going before council to make changes. So kids are definitely wanting to be involved in the process and should be included, and just making sure that, the work that we're doing, we're being intentional on including them and, understanding what their lived experiences are as well. And just also I'm seeing, of course, more of a connection between city and community when it comes to Safe Routes to School. Of course, having both working hand in hand is how we get to our larger goal of ensuring that kids have safer routes to school. And even here in the City of Atlanta, just with my position alone, I know I've worked with city schools even prior to my role. And so just being able to, work for the City of Atlanta and have this as a role to be able to support schools on a local level has made a huge difference in advancing our work to get to Vision Zero as well. And just, continuing to work with parents. Parents definitely play a major role. I've seen lots of parents that have stepped up to become what we call school champions and, just take off with various initiatives which have helped to, enhance Safe Routes to School programming in various communities as well. But I always say that it takes a village. It takes all of us working together to reach a larger goal. And so I think just having those partnerships has really, something I've seen that has made a huge difference with advancing Safe Routes to School work.
Yeah, really incredible. And And also just thanks for all of your work. It's really focused, and you can tell that you've been extremely instrumental in, you know, the achievements. And maybe a last question, what is one thing that we can do to support safe routes to school wherever we are?
Sure. I think just get involved in your local community, see what's happening, you know, identify who the parents are or who the, you know, it doesn't always have to be a parent. It could be a student. It could be a community member. But just seeing how you can, you know, I always say if you see a gap, fill a gap, see how you can fill a gap in a community that may be looking for resources or trying to get more kids to walk or bike to school. And through doing that, you know, that helps us to, you know, increase participation not only in the Safe Routes to School program, but prepare young people to consider walking and biking as a regular activity, something that they will do into adulthood.
Okay. Thank you so much, Nicole. It's so glad to have you. Nicole Hollis,
Safe Routes
to School program. Yes. Program manager at the City of Atlanta, Atlanta DOT. You have been listening to KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. I am Nedra Deadweiler. I would like to thank our hosts, Ian Madin, Nicole Hollis, for all your good work and for being on the show. Thank you to co-host Alon Robb, our engineer Ty Walker, and Chris Smith and Josh Hetrick for making all shows available on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We are in the fundraising season, so thank you for your support for public radio and support of KBOO. May all of your rides be safe, warm, and enlightening, and may you feel more connected to the land and your community. Take care, everyone. See you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.